These are the kinds of conversations that you are invited to in the next few days. We hope to delight, but also to challenge, to educate, but also to incite discussion, conversation, and action. So in opening this next phase of the Ideas Festival, a couple of thoughts. As I always say, do go to something you know nothing about. But this year, we've said this first half, and we're going to say it again. Talk to people you have never met. I could go on, but the time to cross the proverbial aisle is now, right here, right in Aspen, right at the Ideas Festival. We offer a number of ways to mingle, discuss, and meet with each other, both on the paths across campus or over a wonderful lunch or a glass of wine with an author poised to sign a book. I have to say, I wasn't planning to say this, but as many of you know, this will be Walter Isaacson's last Ideas Festival, and as the CEO of the Ideas of the Institute, and he's let us fly, and we owe him a tremendous debt, and the growth of the festival, and the breadth of ideas that we've been able to share with you, and the enthusiasm that he has given our team to bring this event to you is an honor I cherish. Thank you so much.
It's so crass to get a standing ovation, however you can. You know, Walter, that's really...
No, it must be when you decide to leave. Are you feeling that way?
Exactly. They like us a lot better now, right?
I know. Jeff and I are in the category of forgotten but not gone, right? So
I told my successor, you know, every job looks easy when you're not the one doing it, so that you can say the same thing to you.
They still haven't picked my successor, but the entire back of that room are the candidates because it's a really good job to have. So tell me, why did you decide to step down?
Look, I think 16 years of leading a company like GE is a lifetime. We had a group of, candidates in place. I think a lot of the lifting around the portfolio and stuff like that was behind us. And I think when those things converge, it's time to move on. You know, my successor did it for 20 years. It's not a 20-year job today.
You had spent 35 years.
35 years in total with the company, right? So it's from the time I was 26 years old. And personally, I wanted to do one more thing in my life well. And I felt like this was a good time to make that change.
Well, it's leaping ahead to the way you normally do an interview, but you raised it. What type of thing, if you have one more thing to do, what are you thinking of?
So, look, I'd like to, you know, I've run a big company. So I've run a, you know, $135 billion company, global company. I've seen it go through transitions and change. And I think what satisfies somebody that's done what I've done is kind of this notion of building something, seeing something scale, building culture, things like that. And so what I'd like to do is apply what I've learned and do something purposeful, but only one thing, where I can apply some of the things I've learned.
In other words, not have a portfolio.
Not have a portfolio, really. The thought of joining three or four boards, I find to be depressing, really.
Is that from dealing with your own board?
So I think there's a lot somebody like me has to offer in a place like in tech or in healthcare or something like that. But as I've thought about it, really my focus is going to be to do one thing well.
So in other words, take to scale a company that is either in tech or health that might need adult supervision for something. I mean, Eric Schmidt did that. Is that the model?
I'd say that's kind of the model. And I look at all the change that's going on in tech, all the change that's going on in healthcare. And in some ways, I've kind of experienced that and lived through that on my own. And I just think there's a lot I can offer to that. And I want to be purposeful. You know, at the end of the day, it's not anymore about ego, not anymore about money. It's really more about purpose. And, you know, I'm young enough to do that, and that's what I'd like to do.
You know, that's one of the themes at the Institute, is leading a purposeful life. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I think it's the notion that you're doing something that has a bigger impact than what just you are about or what you bring, that basically the collective matters, right? So if you think about a company like ours that provides electricity or transportation or jet engines or healthcare products, nobody comes really to work for a company like GE unless they believe in the mission and they want to really drive technology or sales or the things they do on a global basis. So, you know, really, I would say even today, the recruiting pitch I would use on campus is, if you come to work for GE, in many ways, you're going to sit in the front seat of history. How well American companies do in China, we're going to be there. How well the internet does in the industrial area, we're going to be there. What happens to the future of healthcare, we're going to be there. And as much as I respect, I immensely respect Amazon and Google and Facebook and all the companies that have grown, for them to be the same age as GE, we're going to be in the year like 2130. And we'll see what they're doing and what they look like. And so this resiliency and enduring nature of the company is something that's really turned me on. And that's what I mean by purpose. We have a $30 billion aircraft engine business, and we still have people that go to the airport and watch planes land, right? That's what they love to do. That's their passion. And I like companies like that, right? So we got a little music to go with that, too. Is that for your retirement?
No, that's for the purposeful company. So have you ever had a conflict in running GE between something that would maximize a quarterly return versus something that would be purposeful?
Yeah, look, I think every quarter. I think if you're a public company, you have a... you have multiple responsibilities. My name's not above the door. The company's owned by investors. You got a shifting group of investors, and I've never really shied away from that. Customers are extremely important. Our customers really determine our success. We measure market share as much as we measure any metric in the company. And we have 300,000 colleagues around the world who really have to come to work today, every day, and be motivated. I think the best you can do, Walter, is to be transparent, right? So I take over the company September 7th, 2001. September 11th happened, right? We were big in the aviation business. We had all the reinsurance on the World Trade Center. So we take $1 billion charge that week, and the market opens the next Monday, and our biggest investor sells half their stake, a couple hundred million shares. We get crushed. I kind of said, you know, dude, just slow down a little bit. You know, you're scaring people here. And he said, well, I didn't realize that you were that big in insurance. And I said, well, that's your problem, really, not mine, exactly. You know, in other words, if you own 400 million shares of GE stock, and you didn't really know that's what the exposure was, that's a shared responsibility. So I think where CEOs get in trouble, and where I haven't always been perfect, but we all, is just total transparency. This is what you're investing in. This is how the business works. This is what we sign up for. If we miss it, it's on us. But if you own GE stock and you don't think you're in the aviation business, you're in the wrong company. And so I just think transparency, you know, in 2001, so I go 2001 to 2017. 2001, the word transparency was almost never used fundamentally, right? You go read a balance sheet or a 10K from that era, that then. 10K now is as big as a phone book, right? So I think this notion of transparency is such an important one with all constituencies. And if you're out there, if you're open, if you tell the truth, you're going to be able to navigate between all three.
You've basically turned GE into a technology company. Do you think both for General Electric and for America in general, technology over the next 10 years will destroy jobs or create jobs?
Well, I give you two... two ideas. The first one I'd say, if you're an investor or just looking at companies and things like that, having some kind of technology leadership or moat is actually quite important, whether it's in a platform, whether it's in search, whether it's in data, whether it's in material science. So when I look at companies or just industries in general, I always start there. But I think I think we get lost sometimes in technology, and we want to see episode 10 before we live the pathway of what technology can bring. So right now we have 300,000 people that work for GE. None of them have had a productive day today, not one of them. Not one of them have experienced the hope of technology, digitization, not one. Now, let's say right now we have a field engineer in Texas that's fixing a gas turbine. What's possible for him or her is with 5G, they can get 40 years of experience now in virtual reality. They can fix that gas turbine right the first time. They can have all the expertise that any artificial intelligence would have. That's amazing for them. It's going to make them more valuable. They're going to earn more money. That's great. I don't know why we have to go all the way to we're all going to be robots, right? Why can't we just go through step one, step two, make people more productive? The productivity in this country stinks. It's horrible. Yet all the conversation is we're going to skip every step in between and go all the way to robotics. It's just not true. So I would urge everybody to figure out each technology, right? Artificial intelligence. Does that mean there's not going to be any radiologists in the future? No. What it means is every x-ray has to be, 15% of all x-rays, which is a pretty old technology, have to be reread. Instead of rereading 15%, you reread zero. That's good for healthcare. That makes the radiologist better. And let's just start there.
So how do you train your workers to do that?
Oh, look, I mean, I think what we try to do is marry people with technology. So, you know, kind of our focus is really to take the people that are on the front lines and marry them to how the future of work is going to look and make them more productive. And so that's why in a manufacturing...
Wait, what is the future of work going to look like at GE?
Look, I think what you do is you take administrative work, factory work, field work, engineering work, global work. You apply where the technologies go. What it's going to mean. And so it says for a manufacturing person, instead of doing maybe discrete assembly line manufacturing, what they're really doing is kind of material design, making the part at the same time, and doing multiple tasks. And for that, they're going to get paid $30 an hour, right? Mm-hmm. Their value added is going to be so complete. So you're marrying them to the technology. So there's going to be some repetitive tasks that get replaced. But I think it's going to make a lot of people in factories, in the field, and place in engineering a lot more valuable than they are today.
You're mainly in healthcare, too. I mean, you're a huge healthcare company. What is the future of healthcare? What's the big thing coming next in healthcare for you?
Look, I mean, I think I would mix public policy and technology in healthcare. And I would say, I know we're debating it right now. I ran our healthcare business. We're a big payer in healthcare. You know, we've been doing employee healthcare since 1947. If anybody thinks anybody's going to solve healthcare this year, you're crazy. We're going to be working on healthcare for the rest of our lives, and everybody's going to pay more. People are going to pay more, the government's going to pay more, companies are going to pay more. So let's get those two things out of the way in the beginning. And then I give everybody four things to think about as it pertains to healthcare. One is consumerism. You're never going to fix healthcare unless you link the consumer with the provider, and the sooner that happens and people think about their own wellness in a constructive way, that's got to happen.
Wait, explain what you mean by consumer to the provider.
Look,
you pay for some of your health care.
We went in 2010, 2011, GE went to kind of HSAs, a high deductible plan with our workforce. My wife and I had never read the GE benefits plan, and I ran the place, right? So that was the first time we sat down and said, okay, how much do we want to pay? What's the cost? And that's, you know, pretty sophisticated buyer in a big company. So we're completely divorced between the people, how healthy they want to be. When they sprain their ankle on a Sunday, do they want to go to the emergency room or grab a bag of ice? And then if you're sick, if you have pancreatic cancer or something like that, we need to take care of you. We need to make sure people... So that's consumerism. Chronic disease, 70% of all healthcare dollars are spent on chronic disease. That's only going to get worse because people are going to live longer. And if people start dying of aging diseases, there's no way to estimate what the cost is going to be. So chronic disease matters. Low-cost systems, GE's big in 15 cities in the U.S. The difference in cost per patient, the low city to high city, is 50%. So just by the function of where you live. So getting variance reduction into the system, that's important. And then payment reform. We just have horrible incentives on payment reform. So let's fix one or two of those things. Let's work on them sequentially. But the notion, Walter, that like every time, so we basically from the 1970s or 60s until 2010, we worked in contextually the same healthcare system in the United States. So now if we have to change healthcare plans every time there's an election, so if we're now on four-year cycles with 20% of the country's economy, we're in a bad place. So I think that's all I would offer. So my real answer on healthcare is I don't know.
But those are some ideas.
Those are some ideas anyhow on what some of the problems might be.
But what about the technology of healthcare? What are you building now that's going to be particularly interesting in our lives?
So look, I'd say the ability to, I give you two things. The ability to diagnose disease earlier and treat it more effectively. 40% of the time when you have cancer, you get sent home on the wrong protocol when you come home from the hospital. So marrying imaging technology with therapy so that you get the right therapy out of the box, hugely important. The other one is cell therapy, you know, the ability to kind of do vein-to-vein cell therapy as a way to kind of treat disease or cure disease. Those are massively important. On the technology side, as Americans, we should feel great about where the innovation is. It's just we can't afford it. That's the challenge.
As a company, you know, from aircraft engines to locomotives to energy and everything else, you could probably do more to fight climate change than almost any other entity. How much does climate change affect the decisions you make and the products you make and then the policies that you try to advocate?
So in 2005, we had a group of our scientists study. We did a red team, blue team around climate. And we kind of studied public policy, things like that. We kind of decided climate change was real, but you know, I didn't have like, you know, I wasn't an environmentalist. I had never camped, right? Anything like that. So I was a pure agnostic. Show me the data, show me the proof. That would be. And so we had our own researchers do red team, blue team. They came back, said that. So from 2000 and basically five until today, we've had a huge clean energy initiative, wind turbines, solar, clean gas turbines, water, things like that. And cumulative over that time period, that's $300 billion of revenue. So we've reduced our own carbon footprint by a third. We've generated $300 billion of revenue, and we've improved our productivity. So I'd say in the world of business, we're kind of past this. We're past the political side. The world of business is kind of just, you know, hey, let's go. And the other stuff is just, you know, it's not like Tom Fanning, who runs Southern Company, listened to us not joining Paris and said, okay, I'm going to go build a coal plant. That's just, you know, we're past it all. So I would say, you know, public policy helps, but mainly these ideas are investable. You know, we got in the wind business in 2002. Wind was 30 cents a kilowatt, right? 30 cents. We now are on the grid at 3. So that's learning curve, that's innovation. So we've never viewed this as an elitist initiative. One of the things that happens in environmentalists is it can be too elite, too special. We've always made it grunty. We've always made it about science. We've always made it about technology. We've always made it about people. We've always made it about commerce. And I think when you think about this as a problem to be solved with innovation and not a red state, blue state, or an elitist thing,
so you're big in the wind turbine business. Does it not hurt you when policy changes and it's the subsidies?
Look, I mean, I think clarity is always the best. But, you know, we have the advantage now. 70% of our revenue is outside the United States. If the U.S. doesn't work in wind, Australia will, or Canada will, or China will, or Germany will, and we'll go, you know, someplace else. We have 1,000 people that make wind turbine blades in North Dakota. You know, red state. They better believe in energy efficiency or else they're not going to believe in themselves. So I just think, you know, this is one case, I would say one among many, where, and not that business is perfect, guys, I'm not here to say that, where business is way ahead of government. And it has been that way for a long time and will continue to be ahead.
Actually, you tweeted on climate change. Did you get a reaction from the president?
Not yet. Thanks. Thanks, by the way. Yeah. Thanks. Right. Thanks, by the way. Yeah.
But I mean, you're out there saying.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think most times business people should keep their mouth shut, really, and unless you bring something unique. So, the two places where I've spoken up over time, one is globalization, because we see the world, you know, differently. You know, really, I see the world retail, not wholesale. So I, you know, we have thousands of people, commerce on the ground, so we have a voice in globalization. And then the other places, people like, you know, we've had a clean energy initiative for 12 years. We have tens of thousands of people that are working on it. If you're not willing to stand up for your own people, you're kind of a coward, really. So I think those are the only two times when I speak up, is when we have a unique voice, or when it's supporting the people that I work with every day in an initiative that we think is important.
Globalization has been one of your strands, but it's kind of difficult dealing in China now. You've been pretty successful at it, though. What's happening with China in terms of the economic as well as political competition with the
United States? You know, what I would say, Walter, is I joined GE in 1982, and I'm retiring this year, 2017, 35 years. So in 1982, 80% of GE's revenue was in the U.S., In 2017, almost 70% is going to be outside the United States, right? So that's one generation. And we, you know, again, used to do globalization tops down. Now we do globalization bottoms up. So we believe very much in localization. We have very strong, you know, teams in each one of these countries. So in China, we do $10 billion of revenue. We have 23,000 people. We have 20 factories. It's run by a woman who has worked for GE for 25 years. She went to college in China. She went to business school in the United States. And that's where globalization is today. So, you know, we have the ability to kind of straddle between both places. You know, my job is to make sure we're a good American citizen, which is important to us, but still know how to be a good partner around the world. And American business has had 70 years to get globalization right. If you're a company our age and you still need the government to help you globalize, there's something wrong with you. So I kind of view globalization as something we're accountable for, and basically say to the government, look, fix infrastructure, get tax reform, leave us on our own outside the United States, and we'll fight our own battles and try to navigate a very complicated world. But we're, you know, President Trump didn't invent protectionism. This has been underway for a decade. China is protectionistic. Don't let anybody convince you that we're unique in this vein. This has been going on, I would say, for the last 15 years, and we just have to navigate between it. Localization, you know, what I would call connected localization, using digital technology, things like that, that's really what the world is about for us today.
You make turbine blades, you said, in North Dakota. You have even, I think, some locomotives, other things. What would it take for you to increase by 20-30% the amount of actual manufacturing you do in the United States?
Look, I think the we can make things as inexpensively in the U.S. today as almost any place else. Globalization for me in the 1980s was shutting factories in the U.S. and moving them to Mexico purely for the purpose of wage arbitrage. Those days are over, really. Today, we globalize really for the purpose of serving our customers, getting a local presence in a country, things like that. So we're a big exporter from the United States. We're a $20 billion exporter. We're second only to Boeing, so we still make a lot of stuff here. I think, Walter, in the U.S., we're in a 15-year investment recession in the United States. So one of the things that would make the U.S. do better is a better economy. We would make a lot more things here if the demand was better in the U.S. So fundamentally, whatever tax reform or whatever else it is, on the investment side, the U.S. has been a laggard for the past 10 or 15 years. And then I'd say the other thing is a real desire by, let's say, U.S. Inc. to participate more broadly outside the United States, right? Germany runs their entire country to be an export country. From the politics through the industrial plans through the small and medium enterprises, if we were more like Germany, our exports would be higher. Don't think about China. China's, you know, state-run capitalism. We're not going to copy that model. But we can be more German if we wanted to. You know, Germany's 24% manufacturing. They run a huge trade surplus with us. those are some of the things that I think help the country.
I remember David Bradley's here, and you were in Washington, and one of the, and you were talking about trying to navigate the age of Trump. What is it like to deal with the White House, the age of Trump, where you're nonpartisan, as far as I know, but you're trying to deal with a totally different type of administration?
Thanks, Walter. Thanks for that question. No, I think, look, I think, you know, first and foremost, it's to run a good company. You know, we're business people. We should participate politically when it's meaningful or when we should. But most of the time, like I said, we should just run our companies and run them successfully. I think today, in my mind, it's really agreeing on those things that we think are good and agreeable, and disagree on those things which we think are disagreeable, be willing to speak up personally. So in other words, we don't sign letters anymore. We don't sign 100 company letters anymore. I think that's, you know, we let our own voice speak for ourselves. So I would say agree, disagree, speak for yourself. Mm-hmm. If you can't stand, if you have to join a 100 company letter to let your voice be heard, your voice isn't being heard. Doesn't really matter, right? So I would say those three things, and we're true. Again, we're not perfect. There's a lot of things to pick on in GE, but we're kind of true to who we are. We're true to who we are. We stand up for certain things. You know, so I'd be the first person to say today, this country needs a bilateral relationship with China. The notion of the two biggest economies in the world that don't have a meaningful bilateral relationship, I don't know how many people in this room think that's a good idea. I don't get it, right? So I'm willing to say that. Even
what about Mexico?
I think NAFTA is easier in some ways because one of the strengths that our country has is we have good neighbors, right? We're not next door to North Korea. We don't have guys shooting missiles. It's not like the Canadians are at the border ready to come down and take our stuff, you know? So we've got relatively good people. But the problem is that we're trying to talk about NAFTA today. If the only defense for Mexico in 2017 is cheap labor, the same argument people made in 1992, that's a loser. That's where business is tone deaf. Mm-hmm. That's where business is. If that's going to be the case we make, is that our supply chains are so low cost, and if we don't have NAFTA, everybody's going to pay more at the grocery store, that's a loser in 2017. So sometimes business people, we run the old play, and I think with NAFTA, we just need a new play. But a good, not agreeable, but a strong bilateral relationship with China, everybody in this room needs that.
And the Paris Accord, climate accord?
Look, I think it's always good when the U.S. engages. So in other words, I used to say to President Obama, don't do trade deals for GE. We don't really need them anymore. If we can't navigate the world on our own, do them for yourself. In other words, the U.S. has a powerful military. We also have the world's best economy. If the President of the United States is using both of those, he's stronger. And if we just have a military, but we don't interconnect our economy with anybody in the rest of the world, we're weaker as a country. So I'm not for the Paris Accord because it indicates where we invest. We're going to make the same investments we're going to make. But I worry about it in the regard of it doesn't project strength that we want our country to have on the global stage. And I think we have such a unique country, that's giving something up.
Why did you move the headquarters to Boston?
Well, look, I wanted to be in it. We were in Connecticut for 40 years, so we were a New York City company when Edison founded the company. We moved to Connecticut because the CEO lived there and got tired of commuting into New York. And the taxes were zero back in the day. I think we wanted to be in the city, right? So I'm rarely in the office, but when I was in my office in Connecticut and I would look out my window, I would see nothing, right? I would see a deer running through a field, hopefully running across the Merritt without getting killed, although that wasn't always the case. When I look out my window in Boston, I see a dozen startups, Fidelity, one of our biggest owners, and you just get a different vibe, and it makes you on the edge of your chair. And I think particularly when you're an old company, you really need to get something new in your brain every day, or else you just run the risk of becoming obsolete. We don't want to do that.
And you've invested in a lot. I see Mayor Landrieu there and some people from New Orleans. You did a big investment in New Orleans. Do you think cities are coming back as sort of the creative generator of the new economy?
I really do think that there's something to be said for that. And then I think cities build ecosystems. So when we build a factory today, we tend to want to be around a college campus, right? And it's not just because we get from the college campus, but those tend to have the best high schools. So when we build a new factory, we want to be where the best high schools are. We want to be around where we can train people. Similarly, when you build a software center, you want to be in a place where there's people. We went to New Orleans with Mitch in 2010, more or less. We didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into. You had to have a vision. Sorry, Mitch, but you had to have had a vision in 2010 to be dropping a big investment in New Orleans. Sorry, Walter. It's a great city. And then what's happened in the subsequent time is that New Orleans has become a really great kind of tier two software city. So Silicon Valley is still an amazing place for talent. Seattle is still an amazing place for talent. But then you can drop down to New Orleans or Austin or Chicago, a few other places. So it's now got a tailwind all its own. And we were in on the ground floor of that, and that's going to pay dividends.
And finally, if there's just sort of one great piece of advice for America now, whether it's investing in infrastructure, education, whatever it would be to make us competitive, give us a piece of, you know, most important thought.
Look, I would say for the country, for the long term, it's definitely education. We can't be a rich country if we don't have well-trained people, and we've way fallen behind there. And then I just give everybody in the room simple arithmetic, right? 2% GDP growth solves no problems in this country. Doesn't solve healthcare, doesn't solve Social Security, solves zero problems. 3% GDP growth, we have a shot. The difference between 2% and 3% is to get people reinvesting back in the country. Reinvesting back in the country. Not buying clothes, not buying companies, but building factories. So what's going to make that happen? It's going to be infrastructure, maybe tax reform. And so I would look at it just not from a G standpoint, but sheer arithmetic. Our arithmetic right now doesn't work. In order to get our arithmetic to work, we've got to grow faster. In order to grow faster, we've got to get people investing again. People aren't investing. Even right now, demand for loans is sluggish at best. So education, get people investing again. Those two things.
Thank you,
Ray
very
Walter,
much.
Good to be with you. Congratulations.
Great. Congratulations.
Thank
to you.
Wow. Am I on? I'm on.
On.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. How you
doing? Making a
boss. Water,
spin.
Water. God.
Philadelphia.
Transitions here. God, thank you.
How you doing?
I've got a serious bit of business coming your way right now with Colin Jost and Michael Che. These guys are great. They're great. And everything they say is funny. Every word, every syllable. They have never failed. Every single grunt out of them is brilliant. And here they are for you.
But no expectations.
Okay.
It's so bright out.
Isn't it great? This is a 10. Anyway, last time I was out here, Arthur Schlesinger was here. Remember him?
Yeah.
He used to have ideas out here. Anyway, let's go. Michael, what was it like interviewing President Trump? I saw it on television.
That I interviewed him?
You were interviewing Trump. It was a fabulous. You're face-to-face with him. It was great. Just like Annie Lack likes interviews, just a couple of feet from face-to-face. And you were actually interviewing Trump. You were asking him really good questions.
Well, that was a sketch, man.
What?
No, that was Alec Baldwin in makeup.
Was it?
Yeah, oh, my God. Are you
serious? Well, how did you get... I don't understand this. Well,
very convincing. He's a
you were interviewing somebody else who wasn't the president, and you weren't Lester Holt?
No, I was trying to be Lester Holt, and then I was actually interviewing Alec Baldwin. He played a trick on you, Chris.
Did he?
Yeah, this whole show, it's all a scam. It's fake news.
But that's what I'm getting at. Who can we believe anymore? So what was it like pretending to be Lester Holt, interviewing Alec Baldwin, pretending to be Donald Trump? How do you put that all through your head?
It's nerve-wracking and fun, but it's people seem to like it sometimes, I guess. I don't know. It's
I like it. Let me ask you, because I want to be fair and balanced here in all the questions here. Colin.
Yes. Colin? Hi, Chris.
Jost,
yeah.
Colin Jost. Your name's Colin Jost. That's your
Correct.
Real name. That's your real name.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Who would you rather be? Colin Powell or Colin Firth? Who would you like to be more? This is important, and I've been thinking about this question.
Well, you've been thinking about that
this
question?
If my name were Colin, I would identify with all other Colins and Colins.
Yeah, Colin, I don't really understand why people assume it might be Colin. Like, why would my mom name me Colin? Just disgusting.
Barbara Streisand's looking at me like I'm crazy. This isn't the usual smart Chris. This isn't up to his level. I know that's what she's doing to me. Let's see.
I know what I'll name my son. Let's name him after that section of the body where all the feces pass through. Let's do that.
And by the way, you guys really can't see her face, but she is not happy. She is visibly shaking.
Okay, let's go here. What kind of feedback do you get after you do an SNL and you watch, Baldwin is doing Trump doing Mussolini. I mean, that chin out, my dad used to do this imitation, Mussolini with the chin out. And it's like this really, and that's him. Is Trump that bad?
Is he Mussolini bad?
we'll find out.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's Mussolini.
It seems
bad.
Like the trains are still late, so I don't know.
Oh, my God. You've got a historic record because Mussolini was said to run the trains on time.
That's true.
Let me ask you about the reaction you get. Do you get a lot of hate mail coming in around 12:30 a.m. and Sunday morning after the show's on every week?
We don't check the mail, typically,
no.
After the show.
Modern means of communication. Email.
Twitter, sure.
Finger hut circulars. But not really too many hate mail. It's always going to be hateful. For someone to write a letter, it takes a lot of time to write a letter these days. So you got to be mad for a very long time. You have to like lick an envelope angry.
Yeah. There's not a lot of like, dear Delta Airlines, keep up the good work.
Yeah. Well, he reads that in 2-3 business days.
Colin, what would you advise Mr. Trump if you really liked the guy and knew him and he said to me, should I watch SNL or not? Is it better just hear how bad I look or watch how bad I look and get really mad? What should I do?
I don't think he can stop himself from watching it. It's a compulsion. The way he watches, you look at his office, it's every magazine he's ever been on in one office.
All the country clubs? Isn't that great? He has Time Magazine pretend covers like he's at Six Flags or somewhere, and he can't resist putting himself in the cover. What do you make of that? He's not getting enough ink.
No, it seems like mentally well, stable behavior. Yeah, that's good. No red flags.
So there's a lot of change going on. By the way, Alec Baldwin said he's going to now do it this September. He's coming back.
That's awesome. That's great.
Is that good news, everybody? I think so. So there's been some other changes. This is big news. Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Yeah.
Today, once again, got her moment. Like the understudy gets to be this big star because the star is being yanked at the last minute. Apparently, Sean Spicer got yanked 2 days in a row. Is that portentous for what's coming?
Weird. It seems like he'd been doing a bang-up job. Was there something amiss?
I like that now they realize he was doing bad. Like, hey, maybe we should cut ties with this guy that just yells the first
thing. What about
the
ratings? Isn't Trump ratings conscious? And that doesn't Sean? I mean, we always turn him on for all kinds of reasons, but like news occasionally. But I never seen anybody do a riff like Huckabee did yesterday. And that reporter from the Suburban paper came in and just trounced her. I like that.
I like Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Okay, let's
play.
I
think she's got some spunk. I think she's a lot more coherent, well-spoken than Sean Spicer.
Is it jeans?
Maybe.
Is this whole Huckabee himself coming back?
It's
Mike Huckabee.
I hope not.
I didn't see it last night. I was stuck on a gondola.
So
I
who's
just found
better,
out what that was.
You loved it, right?
I hated the gondola. Well, because I thought it'd be a nice casual boat ride upstream. It's the opposite of that. It's being dangled from the heavens. It sucks, and people pay good money for it. I don't understand why.
And remember when you asked someone at the top if people fall off the chairlift?
Yeah, and the guy was like, all the time. I was like, what? What do you mean? Why are you okay with that? The chair one, because he said that if you don't, you got to make sure you put the bar down on the chair one, because apparently people fall. And then I don't know where you go after that. I guess you just, if you ever see like an
not
occasional,
up. Not
if, you,
up.
If you see like an occasional house on a mountain, that guy probably just fell and was like, well, there's wood here, so let's just build us a cabin. Check out what it's Sarah Huckabee it's Sanders is talking about on.
Where did this all happen? Where did this happen, Michael?
This happened. Well, actually, we rode one today, and it's
gondola.
Like the a gondola.
Oh, here, I thought you were talking about the one in Europe or somewhere with all these people. You got
No.
That's what he was hoping for.
Yeah. I thought it'd be like a nice, pleasant ride. It's not. It's and then you think it's over. It's not over. You just there's
every
so
hill,
much of it.
And then oh, another hill.
Every hill, and it just swings, and the wind is blowing, and it's whispering, "You shouldn't be up here." And you're like, "Yeah, I know, wind." Just and then it just stops. And there's no intercom, like, "Hey, this happens all the time." You just gotta guess it happens all the time. And that's it.
So all my material was political, but it's better. Anyway, we're out in the mountains here. We're playing the local material, right? Using local material, living off the land. That's good. Let me ask you about... I'm going back to my clipboard here.
I'm sorry.
Huckabee Sanders.
Right.
Sean Spicer or Melissa McCarthy. Who's the best?
At comedy?
Spicer.
Isn't it crazy that we know all these people? Like, you know them so well. Like, 3 million people a day watched Sean Spicer.
Yeah.
We know everyone that advises Trump. Mm. We didn't know. We knew, like, Valerie Jarrett with Obama. We didn't know. I mean, general people in the world didn't know his whole team. We know everyone he deals with.
I think it's weirder than that. We know Carter. We know Carter Page.
Carter Page,
the Cato Kalin of this thing.
Yeah.
This character that seems to be floating in the house somewhere, living there, but who is he? Did he play any part in this thing? Probably not, but he loves it. This guy is unbelievable. He is Cato Kalin, this guy.
He looks like such a psycho.
Carter Page. He's the only guy that calls us up and says, "Can I come on?" to talk about a scandal he's in.
Yeah.
No, nobody ever calls you and says, "Can I be in my scandal?" It just never happened. So what's this cross-dressing thing? I know everybody's pretty progressive here, and I don't know what your views are, but the biggest put-down, it seems to be, is to cross-dress these people. What's going on with... I mean, I don't know what... I don't know Spicer. I don't like him or dislike him, but I knew he's been around a long time. But all of a sudden, he finds himself on Saturday Night Live, and he probably said to himself, "Well, that's cool." And then he say, "You're a woman tonight." Okay. I mean, all of a sudden, a change in life experience.
Oh, you mean Melissa playing
Yeah, all of a sudden, she's got this mobile podium. it's like an attack. It has two speeds, ramming and attack. And it's almost like a terrorist going into a mob. And it goes into the press section.
Way to lift the mood.
Over. Huh? What do you make of this character? And then we got...
Did this used to be a sailboat? Whose idea was this?
I think I'm in Being... You know what you remind me of? Peter Sellers and Being There. You're like, "Oh, I'm here. I like to watch." I mean, what about Kate McKinnon as Jeff Sessions? That bit of brilliance with the lip rolled up.
I love it. I think it's all funny.
What do you think they think of it? Jeff Sessions down there in Alabama or wherever he is, you think they like it down there in the bayou?
I think people like it because I think when most people are watching it, even if no matter what side you're on, you're kind of like, doesn't he kind of remind you of a racist Forrest Gump? And then you see someone else has the same idea and you're like, "Oh yeah, I'm not crazy." And I think that's why it kind of appeals to people. The Spicer, Melissa McCarthy. I think when everyone saw Spies there, everybody like, yeah, somebody like that would kill that. And it worked.
It's more about energy and than it is about gender.
Yeah, but didn't he, when I look at Spice from the beginning, I kept thinking, this guy behaves so nervous like he knows the nanny cam is on.
Yeah.
You know? And the parents are watching him. And I know I didn't hit the kid. You know, I didn't. I mean, it's like the whole thing is scared. He looks scared to death.
It seems like they just briefed him that he has to spin this. And he's like, well, I don't want to do it. And like, just do it. So he's frustrated that he has to do it too. Because he knows that he doesn't believe what he's saying. There's no way that he believes half the things he's saying.
Yeah, and then she comes on and says it's all fake. And she was really crazy yesterday, I thought. She was wild, you know?
Yeah, well, you know.
Anyway, let me ask you about... I've been watching this Trump family. And I still think the biggest news every morning when your eyes wake up and you are who you are in your morning. And it's morning and here's life again. And I still think the biggest news every morning is Trump's president. I still think that's the news. I just think it's like the film broke and something, or like the Joker in Batman. All of a sudden, you're watching the Joker, and you go, "Wait a minute! I was watching the news."
But you like him?
I don't want to get into that. When I knew him before this gig, he said, "Now I found him, you know, okay." But he was a business guy and just showing off and all. I said, "Yeah, I interviewed him 20 times. He was a little different, but
yeah, I mean, it's different.
I
mean, like,
I never, you know. He didn't have my country in his hands. I have a totally different attitude about him.
Yeah, I actually do like him. I just wish he wasn't our president.
I remember on Letterman one night. Letterman had a Joe Theismann on or some football quarterback on, and he needed somebody to stand on the roof of another building near the Ed Sullivan Theater. He just needed somebody to stand there and catch the ball so he could do this outdoor scene he did on that show. And guess who showed up in a trench coat to catch the ball, just so he could be there to catch the ball? Trump. This thing about constant. Let's talk about this Trump family, because it's not just him. He comes in an entourage, and it's like I call them the Romanoffs. I mean, they move together. They don't move as one. He shows up, and you look quickly there. There's Ivanka. She's always there. And there's Jared looking perfect. Now, Melania's not always there, but
you think he looks perfect?
Oh, yeah, he's perfect. That guy's perfect. By the way, what do you think of having Harpo Marx as our foreign policy guy? I mean, the guy hasn't spoken yet. Nobody's ever heard him speak, and he's our spokesperson in the Middle East. How does he talk to Bibi and those guys?
I think that's part of the plan, maybe.
Huh?
Maybe that's part of the plan, but he just doesn't say anything.
I think I got cut out of the show, but when Jimmy Fallon was playing him on our show at the end, he just said one thing and just talked like Mickey Mouse as Jared Kushner, and it was pretty great. But I don't know if that got cut out.
No, yeah, definitely did.
Is that how you avoid being imitated?
Yeah, just
don't talk. Now, what do you think of these people? Ivanka.
I like her.
I keep thinking of the song from Kiss Me, Kate, Bianca. Somebody's got to sing a song like that. Ivanka. I mean, she's always in the picture. Is she like the crown princess? I mean, it seems royal to me. It should be.
Show of hands. Did anyone else's brain go to the Kiss Me, Kate song? Anyone else have that on the forefront of their minds?
This is an ideas festival.
That's right.
It treasures innovation and the unusual.
Are you just pitching us sketch ideas?
Yeah. Use what you can. Mike Pence.
Oh, my God.
Did you ever watch him? He's like waiting. Look at him. He said, what's your active verb, Mike Pence, today? What is your action? What are you doing today, Mike? I'm waiting. I just see him. He's always a few feet from the camera, off to the side. And I get the feeling he's just, I know I'll be there when the time comes. And I'll own it all. What do you think of Mike Pence?
I like him.
Why?
If these people were, if Trump was president of any other country, I'd be like, yo, Donald Trump is hilarious. But he's ours, so it's not that funny. Everybody likes drunk dad, but not when he's your drunk dad.
That's pretty good.
What a brilliant thing to make Mike Pence as vice president, too. Because he's like, oh, you want to come after me? Look who else is waiting.
It's pretty funny.
He reminds me of one of those characters in Da Vinci Code. You know, the supernumerary that Paul Bettany played. They just look a little scary.
Yeah, something's off there. Something's...
I don't know. Let's keep an eye on the...
Keep an eye on that? Okay.
Da Vinci Code. Okay, this is the big part. This is the ideas part of the set here. Trump is our 45th president. No matter what we say or do, or he says or do, he will always be in the history books as our 40th. This is, to me, the news of the day. Mm-hmm. Our president of the United States is Donald J. Trump.
Yeah, man.
He really is. And he's done nothing, actually, to prove it since coming into office, but he is. And I was thinking, when they always list the presidents, people like Schlesinger and the historians get together and they try to rank the presidents. Now, he's been in office almost half the first year. Where would you rank him in the 45 presidents? I guess we have to count Grover Cleveland once or twice. I forget how we do that.
Well,
where would you rank him?
In terms of reverse order of being president, he's number one.
I would ask you, how would you rank him so far in our presidents, in our great presidents, starting with the big three at the top, Lincoln, you know, Washington and FDR. And then nobody competes in that three. But after that.
Fillmore.
What's Fillmore's first name?
Millard.
Okay, that's good.
Wait, Mallard's the president, Millard's the duck, right?
I think Millard's the beer.
Millard Light.
Michael,
yeah.
you want to give him like 43rd?
Well, that's hard for me.
Put him
like the first 15 owned people. So.
Oh my God.
I'll say maybe bottom 17.
Maybe Trump was reparations. What do you think?
That would be a curveball.
We'll make him pay. That would
suck.
I'm not rooting for him to be a bad president. I'm rooting for him to be a good president. I think we will all be better off if he's a good president.
I would be surprised, but I'm rooting for it. So, who do you think Trump hates more, journalists or comedians?
I honestly think journalists, because I do think comedians he occasionally will laugh at, and journalists he just hates. That's what I think.
Hates.
Yeah.
Well, I think he identifies with. I don't even think he hates us. I think he thinks he's better than us. Like, he probably thinks he's the funniest guy.
Yeah, that's true.
That's really all it is. He hates us because he's like, I could be funnier than that guy. But journalists, I think he really hates.
Really?
Well, I mean, I think he plays the. I mean, he's been famous for 30, 40 years. He knows the game.
I think, though, he's really smart with journalists, because I also think, even I think attacking journalists in a weird way makes journalists want him to like them more. I think that really, there's some psychological thing there. He's played journalists
really?
So well for so long of his... Think about how many newspaper articles have been written about him. He loves that. That's what he wants.
Yeah, you say, let's have... I always love in groups like this, and everybody does, to find out what it's like on the inside.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They can see the rest on TV and they can read about it, but they don't get the inside story. So you guys, you're not really newsmen exactly, but you are newsmen in a sense.
Yeah.
No, you can say, no, that's not true, because a lot of people sort of pick up on what's going on. Maybe they're working hard at school, or when you're in school, you don't really keep up with things that much. But I think a lot of young people, all kinds of people, pick up on stuff off the top of it. And you guys deal with the top of the news. What's really sort of the foam at the top of the news, what's really everybody's picking up on. When do you start putting it together, Michael? Tell me how you put the show together every week.
We're both sketch writers, so the first like 3 days, we have a writing staff that writes a lot of jokes for us. So they're writing jokes the whole week. But I think for me and Colin, the first 3 days we're kind of writing sketches, and then after Wednesday, by Wednesday night, Thursday, we start thinking about what, because the news cycle has been moving so quickly that what's the story Monday is almost irrelevant by Saturday. So a lot of times we don't even really start figuring out what the show is actually going to be, what the segment's actually going to be, until about Thursday, Friday night. And then we start to put it together and do jokes that way. But for the most part, other than, you know, the island jokes that we do towards the end of the segment where we do, like, you know, a turtle in Florida jokes. But other than that, for the main news stories, we kind of start that Thursday, Friday into Saturday.
Does Lauren edit you guys?
We might have things earlier in the week, but then I don't know if you know, but our president goes on this thing called Twitter on Friday a lot.
Yeah.
And so that can sometimes throw out everything we have.
There's at least three
before
episodes.
Friday.
There's at least three episodes I can count where we had by Thursday or by Friday we had to scrap our episode, like pretty much scrap our segment because this was the big story now. And it's like, whoa. It's kind of hard to keep up. People think that it's great because it's so much content, but it's not. And also, he beats us to the punchline most of the time. So it's.
And he can somehow say stuff as president that we can't say on network television.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, well, that's strange too.
Do you have to do a self-editing around Saturday morning? You have to, like, say, we better be careful of that one. The old dog, when in doubt, leave it out. When in doubt, put it in. What's your rule on that? When it's
well, one of those rhymes, so it
sounds
catchier.
I know. I don't know
when
whether
in
people.
Doubt, put it in.
Larry King used to say, "When in doubt,
dangerous.
Put it in."
When in doubt, put it in.
When in doubt, put it in.
What kind of weird college
you're
did
welcome,
he go to?
You're welcome, Aspen.
When in
go
doubt,
home
put
and
it
use
in.
That knowledge.
No, that's the old Groucho Marx line, which I won't use anyway. Remember that one?
No.
I'm not going to refresh your memory either.
Okay. Yeah, please don't.
Because
we'll talk
of the show.
After.
So, you love it?
Who?
What you do? Saturday night, it's over. You're like, this is it. It's in the can. We've done it live. This is what everybody in America is now thinking about. It's just a fabulous thing you guys get to do every week.
We love it, and we feel very lucky to get to do it. We're always, when the show ends, we're always like, oh, I wish I had that back. I wish that, you know, it takes days for you to be not very self-critical of whatever you just did, I think.
Yeah, you love it in hindsight, but when it's happening, it's.
You only see the mistakes. It's the same if you write a sketch, then one line gets flubbed, and that's all you think about. And you talk to your friend, and they're like, I didn't even notice that.
Well, who's your daddy? I mean, a print journalist for years was Ben Bradley. Everybody, I include everybody, wanted Ben Bradley to say, you're good, you're important, you're doing the job. I respect you, I admire you. Is that like Lorne? Is Lorne like a daddy? Did say Lorne Michael? Does he say, you know, you guys really did it tonight? Or
is this therapy?
Yeah, I'm asking you. How important is it to get Lorne's approval?
The headline for this is Michael Che and Colin Jost says Lorne is their daddy. And you're like, oh man. There were other things
in that
segment.
Way. I don't mean who's your daddy.
No.
You want approval?
Yeah, of course. I mean,
okay, everybody applaud these guys. Come on. they want approval.
All
that's
right.
That's great. Who doesn't?
That was fun.
It wasn't funny. It was useful. So we live in a world where crossing the line happens all the time, and when it happens, it's like horrendous. And I don't ask you to judge on this, but Kathy Griffin, of course, and Bill Maher, there is a line out there, and I think it moves. I swear it moves. You never know what's going to be, a bad day or two, or my God, it's a career, or you don't know what, is there a line? Is there something, is there a line that's objective about what is just unacceptable, whether it's anti-woman, an ethnic group that is just, or a sexual gender or whatever, orientation?
I think everybody has their own personal line. And, you know, what offends you might not offend me. I just think, as a comedian speaking selfishly, I just wish if something, you know, crosses your line, it's not something that you say, well, no one else can enjoy it because I didn't enjoy it, you know. There's also a time where there's certain jokes that just aren't for you. There's a lot of jokes or a lot of things that I see that offends me. But it's, you know, it just offended me. That doesn't mean it should be everybody else's line. Just because you have your line doesn't mean that it should be the line for everybody. And I think that's where it starts to get tricky when they say, okay, this is wrong and everyone should agree on it, even though not everybody should agree. You know, even if everybody doesn't agree. I think that's a little weird that everybody has to have the same line. What happened to just being individuals and saying, well, that didn't bother me as much as it may have bothered you, and I'm going to move on.
I think that's why it's harder to be liberal in America now than it is to be conservative.
Well, you gotta
America.
Be undefeated. As
because
a liberal.
If you're conservative, you can kind of say whatever you want. People are like, oh, they're conservative.
Yeah.
But if you're liberal and you say like one thing that's not in what someone has decided is the liberal agenda, they're like, no, you're dead to us.
You're so right. Like
Elon Musk.
Everybody has to be locked.
Elon Musk was just meeting with the president. People are like, no, and he's like, yeah, but it's to help clean energy. They're like, no, kill yourself.
Anyway, thank you. He's the greatest. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Chris Matthews, everyone.
Thank you, Chris.
We're done.